Hello and welcome. I'm Mark Steiner. This is another one of our Urbanite broadcasts. In the December 2008 issue of the Urbanite magazine, there was an interview and conversation with Dr. Stephen J.K. Walters, who's an economics professor at Loyola College here in Baltimore, Maryland. He had written earlier, last summer, an article in the Wall Street Journal called Blame Taxes for Baltimore's Rot, which set off a firestorm of controversy in the city and around, in which he called for cutting Baltimore City's property tax to 1%. And people were inflamed in the city government. And what the Urbanite did was to call Dr. Walters and say, let's have a conversation that is a little bit more calm, that talks about who you are and what you're actually proposing here. That was done by Michael Amft and photographed by Leo Howard LeBeau, that you can find on the Urbanite website in the Urbanite magazine during the month of December. And let me welcome Stephen Walters. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's talk about this thesis of yours. I mean, it is in many ways an anathema, what you're describing, what you will describe, to many liberal urban thinkers. So let's talk about what you're suggesting and what you're suggesting in the article that caused you to be pilloried so.
Well, the controversy revolved around some intemperate rhetoric. We were we used the metaphor of the Wire's characterization of a lot of Baltimore City neighborhoods as fundamentally realistic, and that really rubbed people the wrong way because people love Baltimore and they don't like what they love to be called names or to be characterized uncharitably. And we love Baltimore too. We want the best for it. What we wanted to say was Baltimore is really two cities. It's tax break Baltimore and it's tax broken Baltimore. So the whole redevelopment strategy of the city revolves around giving special tax breaks to certain neighborhoods and leaving the tax rate high everywhere else. And we think that's fundamentally unfair. We think that there can be a much more organic, more genuine and enduring renewal if Baltimore will address its property tax problems for everybody, not just for some favored few developers. Now, the big picture story here that we have to tell, not just about Baltimore but about every place, is when we think of cities, we tend to think of cities as just dense concentrations of people. But we mm-hmm. have to start thinking of cities as dense concentrations of physical capital, as we economists call it, structures, infrastructure, dense concentrations of capital that attract people. So the first condition to make a healthy city, a vibrant city, has to be you have to be friendly to capital. You have to attract a high-quality, abundant stock of capital that people will want to cluster around and that people that employers will want to use, that will create jobs, will create wealth for its residents. If you're friendly to capital, a lot of the other important parts of a healthy city will fall into place. So that's the big thesis. So what's Baltimore doing that's not friendly to capital? Well, its property tax rate is both too high absolutely and too high relatively. It's too high relative to the surrounding county. The Baltimore City property tax rate is more than twice as high as the surrounding county. So if you want to be in the Baltimore area, if you want to invest in business development, if you want to invest in residential development, you can go a few miles away and you can pay a property tax rate that's less than half as high. And so we're diverting a lot of residential and commercial investment out into to the suburbs, and we're sprawling. And if you're interested in smart growth, you should be very interested in reversing that property tax bias against high density development. So you've got a relative problem, but you've also got an absolute problem. The property tax rate is so high. I think of the property tax as like a capital gains tax that you render every year. When you add up the annual year after year hit that you take with the city's property tax rate, the property tax is so high here that very often an amount that you might be considering investing can be less than the tax liability that you will incur by investing it. In other words, investments become worthless because the long-term future tax liability of the investment that you might make will swamp the value of the investment that you're creating. So you've got an absolute problem and a relative problem. You got to fix it, or the city's going to continue to sort of tread water here with respect to its redevelopment.
So, and you're suggesting that if we cut the tax rate in Baltimore, then to this 1% mm-hmm. margin that you're talking about, it's 1.1% in Baltimore County, you said,
right?
When we talked earlier, that it would eventually, you're saying, in your argument here,
yes,
create more revenue for the city of Baltimore than the higher tax rate does at this moment.
Yes.
Is that your argument?
Yeah. There are two ways to raise tax revenues. You can have a high tax rate or you can have a broad tax base. So what we're saying here is once you reduce the tax rate, once the tax base broadens, you will eventually collect more tax revenue, not just from property taxes but from all other related taxes. Baltimore's got a piggyback income tax. Baltimore needs people to want to locate here so that those people can carry their income tax revenues to the city coffers. Now, this isn't just an argument. Mm-hmm. When we started to examine this issue, social scientists are big on what we call natural experiments. Has this ever been done before? And if it has been done before, what happened? Well, the two big examples of cities that turned themselves around completely with an involuntary property tax cut, one from the East Coast with bad weather just like ours, one from the West Coast with good weather. On the East Coast, we have Boston. On the West Coast, we have San Francisco. Both of those cities are port cities. Both of those cities have very progressive political cultures like we do. Their histories are very similar to Baltimore's. And up until the mid to late 70s, they were headed in the same direction that Baltimore was headed. That is, they were losing population rapidly. They were high crime areas. People are shocked to hear that those cities' crime rates were actually higher than Baltimore's in those days. Poverty rates were comparable. What happened? What changed those cities into what we now refer to as superstar cities? Well, the taxpayers statewide in those areas became indignant about the property tax liabilities that they were subject to. So they had a tax revolution in each of those states. First in California, Proposition 13 stipulated a 1% property tax rate on residential property. And a couple of years later, Proposition 2.5 in Massachusetts drastically cut Boston City's property tax rate. In the immediate aftermath of those property tax cuts, there was reinvestment in those cities. There was repopulation in those cities. People brought their disposable income dollars. They started spending their money in the cities. They started wanting to live in those cities again. Jobs started going back to those cities. And there was a massive turnaround in both of those cases. Now, they didn't want to do it. The mayors of both of those cities thought, we can't afford this. It was forced upon them. But the results were dramatic. And within a few years, both of those cities had budgets that were healthier than they had been before the property tax cuts.
Let me go back to the beginning and kind of work through all the things you just said here. When you argue that we're again arguing here about this 1%, taking our property tax down to 1%,
mm-hmm.
You talked about two Baltimores, the tax break Baltimore and the tax Baltimore.
Right.
And so the tax break Baltimore being when you want to bring a hotel or investor or something into Baltimore, you give them these massive tax breaks so they will build in Baltimore.
Right.
And let me say this. A, are you arguing that Baltimore County, Anne Arundel County, Howard County don't do this? They don't give tax breaks?
They don't do this nearly to the extent that Baltimore City finds it necessary to. And we've been doing it since the late 50s. I mean, starting with Charles Center. In the 50s, the redevelopment plan for Baltimore was essentially laid out. The city leaders looked at Baltimore City and realized we've got a huge disinvestment crisis here. Nobody's building any office buildings. Nobody's building any hotels. Nobody's building anything much downtown. And they quickly realized that part of the reason was property taxes will punish those investments. Again, it's a capital gains tax, and you could go a few miles away, and the capital gains tax is less than half what you'll pay in the city. So from the Charles Center project on, most of the redevelopment plans, actually all of the redevelopment projects that I've seen of any size, have involved a tax subsidy, either payments in lieu of taxes or tax increment financing or explicit agreements with the developers to set a low assessment on the invested property so that the effective property tax in the city on these select developments will be comparable to that in the county. We've been doing that for years, but we only do it for the favored few. And my point would be, if that's a good idea for redevelopers of large-scale projects downtown, why isn't it a great idea all over town?
But the other two cities we have in Baltimore are the cities of means and the city's residents who have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
We have two Baltimores, a wealthy
right.
Baltimore and a poor Baltimore.
Right. Tax break and tax broken Baltimore.
I'm talking about the people, not just the
yeah.
fiscal side of the,
right.
the city.
Right.
So there's an argument people would make, well, look, you know, it sounds wonderful to have these tax breaks for to attract wealthier homeowners to bring businesses into the city. That could happen. But a huge portion of the money that we spend in Baltimore City, people would argue, goes A, $200 million or more for our public schools that gets contributed to the schools, to sanitation, to police, to fire, to fixing potholes. Those things cost money. And if you don't have the tax base, the tax money in the city, you don't have the money to do that.
Well, the question is, how do you get the tax base? Let's talk about poverty for a second. What we're talking about is capital and capital friendliness. Well, think of capital as tools. If I send you out to dig a hole in the yard out there with your bare hands, you'll be able to dig a hole, but it'll take you a long time. If I give you a tool, if I give you a shovel, or if I give you a backhoe, physical capital, you'll be much more productive. Your wage will go up. You'll become wealthier because you're more productive. So here we are. Well, we need capital. People don't just become poor accidentally. People become poor because the capital that they need to work more productively and become wealthy has leached out into the surrounding suburbs and left them destitute. So what I'm arguing here is you need to be friendly to all kinds of capital. We're not just talking about building nice houses for the middle class and attracting them back to town. We're talking about building employers again so that the people who are already here can earn higher wages because they're more productive. We tax residences at 2.268% per year, but we tax business and commercial property by 2.5 times that. Well, it's no surprise that most of the businesses and most of the factories have moved elsewhere or just closed. So we need to get all this kind of capital back. We need to build the tax base in all its forms so that the poverty problem will be addressed by more than transfer payments, but it'll actually be addressed by creating employment opportunities and higher wages and more wealth for the people who are already here.
We're talking with Stephen Walters, who's an interesting article with Michael Amt appeared in the December issue of Urbanite. This is your Urbanite broadcast here on the Mark Steiner Show. It was photographed by Leo Howard Lebeau in the December issue and written by Michael Amt. And we're talking with Dr. Stephen Walters, professor of economics at Loyola, about his idea of creating a 1% property tax for the city of Baltimore that has caused a great deal of conversation. You make a strong argument about what happened in San Francisco and in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's some who would argue the difference between San Francisco and Boston and Baltimore City is those cities have been, especially Boston, white cities.
Mm.
And that a part of the flight in Baltimore had as much to do with race as it did economics. People fleeing, even though there's been a large black middle class that flew out to Liberty Road in Baltimore County as well.
Right, yeah, good point.
But that they were essentially white cities, and the things that divides a city as much as anything else is the question of race that may not be taken into account in terms of the what you're talking about in terms of the stories of what happened in Boston and San Francisco.
Well, that's a great point, great question. Let's remember, we have to understand, San Francisco and Boston, though whiter than Baltimore, were losing population just as fast, if not faster, through the late 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. There was flight from an environment that punished capital investment as much as there was flight from anything else. It wasn't particularly race-related in those cities. It was related to tax policy, and it was related to a lack of economic opportunity. That turned around for those cities, and it really hasn't turned around here. And that's why there's a lot of confusion about, well, gee, isn't race contaminating this debate in Baltimore? I mean, I think it's a much more important argument that I'm making for a predominantly black city
because
to show this is not a race issue. This is an economic issue. This is a capital issue. I mean, I think it would be one of the signal achievements for Baltimore to step up and do this tax change voluntarily and say a predominantly black city can grow and prosper just like other cities have grown and prosper when they create fruitful conditions for economic development. That's one of the reasons I'm in here with my shoulder to this particular wheel. I love Baltimore. I love it as it is, but I think it can be made so much better, and I especially think it can be made better for its predominantly black population. Going back to the poverty discussion, the reason that Baltimore has such an enduring poverty problem is because of capital flight. It's not because of white flight. It's because of capital flight.
The of course, some people might argue that the white flight had as much to do with race as it did with anything capital-based.
Yeah, but as you noted, blacks flee a capital unfriendly environment with the same propensity that whites flee a capital unfriendly environment. And once you create a capital friendly environment, it's an equal opportunity wealth creator. It makes everybody more productive. It makes everybody wealthier. And both blacks and whites will find that it's just a whole lot easier to make a nice living in an environment where capital investment is not punished at the rate that it's punished in this city.
Now, I'm going to make a kind of paint a picture of what the city will look like under your plan ideas. But let me answer this question first. Some people I've read argue that your ideas. You and Steve Hanke together.
Right.
Say his name.
Steve Hanke is an economist at Johns Hopkins.
Johns Hopkins University. Right. That this is ideologically, philosophically, something that comes out of places like the Cato Institute, libertarian economic thinking, that doesn't like government spending to begin with, and that this really has more to do with how to kind of lessen government involvement and government input into society that as it does with creating a different kind of tax base for the cities. Right. Is that a fair argument people make about this?
No, I think it's kind of an amusing argument because here I am citing San Francisco and Boston, two city cultures that no one would cite as particularly free market or libertarian, at least with respect to economic policy, as examples of how
policies,
we ought. Yeah, I mean... These are not cities that you would point to and say, that's what, you know, the Cato Institute has created. I mean, what happened there can happen anywhere. It can happen in any political culture. This is not something that is, you know, sort of knee-jerk free marketism. I mean, that's one of the things that we get dismissed. One of the charges here is, they just want lower taxes. And those libertarians or those right-wingers always want lower taxes because they want to starve the government. Well, both San Francisco and Boston, because they've broadened their tax bases, actually have city governments that spend more per capita than Baltimore does. They have the resources to do a lot of good because they've taken the pains to broaden the tax base. We don't because we just haven't taken this step. I mean, we are starving ourselves. And I mean, you can be progressive, you can be libertarian, you can be culturally conservative, but unless you have the tax base present to provide the transfers that many people need, well, you know, you're just not going to be able to do much good. And again, there's an organic way to do good. There's a way to provide jobs and opportunity and create wealth with capital investment. And we want to do that, too. We don't want to just create a transfer society. Sometimes we've referred to cities that do what Baltimore has done over the past several decades as they're buying into Robin Hood government. You look at capital and you look at whether it's business investment or whether you look at it as residential investment. Those are the wealthy capitalists. We need to tax the rich and give to the poor. Well, you know, this is what Robin Hood found out. After you've robbed some people in Sherwood Forest a few times, people don't go to Sherwood Forest anymore. There's a limited amount of rich people that you can rob in order to give to the poor. At some point, you actually have to have a legitimate going concern here to be genuinely progressive, and we're sort of losing that.
Samir, this is not quite on point, but some people would argue that as the difference in this last presidential election, which is that those who make more should be taxed greater. Mm-hmm. And that some people were arguing that even with a notion like this, that we're really not taxing wealth at all in America because most wealth is outside the income. Most great wealth is outside income tax structures, so we're not even taxing that.
But notice what you just did. You went from Baltimore to America.
I did. Yes.
Yeah. And see, this is the tricky thing for local leaders.
Okay.
You can't talk about America if you're the mayor of Baltimore or the a local politician because your borders stop a few miles from where we're sitting. And capital and rich people, they're mobile. Like I say, they do have the choice not to go through Sherwood Forest to get their pockets picked. Now, America as a whole, well, that's a different thing. You know, we can talk about national tax policy, but this really isn't germane to the policymaker at the local level. The policymaker at the local level has to be very concerned about, like I said before, this relative tax disadvantage that we're at. You know, you can go a few miles away and you can cut your tax bill in half on a particular investment. So So a lot of the progressive ideology that says, well, tax the rich and give to the poor has to, you know, recognize this fundamental reality, and you have to limit the extent to which you try to punish the rich in order to serve your agenda. I mean, Boston's tax rate was just announced as going down again from under 1.1% to 1.06%. While everybody else is looking for ways to cut spending and trim this program and that program, well, Boston's tax base is sufficiently well-developed and Boston's economy is sufficiently diversified that they're doing exactly the right thing in the teeth of this recession because of their previous policy. So I just want to emulate cities like Boston and San Francisco. They're very progressive cities. I don't expect Baltimore to become anything other than a progressive city. I just want it to be a healthy city.
So let's take a look at where you think what you think this will do for Baltimore. You showed me before we started talking a graph and an article. Oh, I should
the
say.
Audience is worried now. Graphs, look out.
They can see it on our website. they can look at your graph there and read the 1% solution. That you have, we'll post all the things we're talking about on the website.
Okay.
You can see everything that we're talking about here. Yeah, but you talk about San Francisco, and how the sales and use taxes grew by 39%, utility taxes by 64%, 135% parking revenues, construction permit fees 167%, payroll taxes grew 177%, hotel taxes 204%, and business license taxes 446%. I don't know what that means in real dollars, but that's what you're saying. What happened to San Francisco after 4 years of being forced to drop their property tax?
Right.
And how does that relate to Baltimore?
Well, I would submit that the same thing would happen in Baltimore. The immediate effect of an announced cut in the property tax rate from its current level to under Baltimore County's would unleash a flood of investment in this city. And here's the big advantage that Baltimore has over San Francisco. We have a piggyback income tax on which we depend for a lot of our city tax revenue. So Baltimore just desperately needs more people. With more people will come more income tax revenue, as well as the real estate tax recordation fees and so forth would realize when people started reinvesting in the city. Just attracting more residents, the piggyback income tax is levied not by where you work, but by where you live. So even though a lot of people work in Baltimore, if they go home to the suburbs at night, they take their tax revenues home with them to another jurisdiction. So the first and most important effect of this would be people will start looking at housing and other and business development in Baltimore much more favorably than they ever have in the past. They would start looking at a lot of neighborhoods that need sprucing up, and they would start to say, gee, now if we spruce it up, if we invest in rehabbing and so forth, we're not punished with this huge capital gains tax that we have in Baltimore City. So people will start to repopulate. That happened in San Francisco. That happened in Boston. In both cases, dramatic reductions in population were reversed almost instantly. But in Baltimore, you'll have this favorable spillover benefit of once people start to relocate here, they'll start paying their income taxes to the city. And if you want to spend some of that on programs that alleviate poverty, you'll actually have the resources to do that. I mean, the other great thing about having more people in Baltimore is, I mean, this is the smartest smart growth policy I can possibly imagine. If you're concerned about suburban sprawl, well, you should be concerned about the city's high property tax rate, because what that's doing is it's creating this tremendous incentive to develop further out where the property tax rates are low. If you reverse that, then you'll have higher density development. That'll make the streets safer. More people will make the streets safer. More people will make public transportation more economical. More people will make the schools healthier. More people will create a critical mass of audiences so that there'll be more entertainment and more amenity in the city. I mean, Baltimore used to house 950,000 people. We can have 50% more Baltimoreans than we now have, but we've got to create an environment where people will actually say it's not economically foolish to do that.
We're talking right now with our guest, Stephen Walters, economic professor at Loyola University here in Baltimore, Maryland, who wrote the article in the Wall Street Journal that caused a firestorm, and a very interesting article written about him and his work called The One Percenter in the December issue of...
I want to compliment Mike Amft, the writer. He was so conscientious, spent so much time with me. I really thought that was a great article, and also Leo for the photograph, too.
Which is one of the reasons you should read The Urbanite.
Yeah,
this is Urbanite Broadcasting here on The Mark Steiner Show. One final thing here I would have to get into, because it was a really interesting article, and I'm looking forward to kind of exploring over the months even more in-depth this discussion and inviting
you. We won't
you to,
go away. We're not going to go away. We're going to be chanting this this hymn for a long time.
And rather having you sit and debate in public, frighten city officials, I'd like to have a discussion with people from around the country about this and have you be part of it, because I think it's a very important piece of urban policy that you're suggesting. But you also, before we leave, have to introduce you to a way you'll find out about him in the Urbanite magazine. You're more than just an economist, I understand, that they throw these little tidbits to hear about you in baseball.
Well, I am a sports economist too. It seems to me there are two reasons to do economics. One would be that it's important, which is what we're talking about before.
Right.
And the second is that it's fun. So being a sports economist has been the most fun I've had professionally, because I got to advise a couple of teams about exactly how much to pay guys like Johnny Damon or Hideki Matsui, or I would be called in to look over contract offers and say, is this guy worth it? Is he worth it here? And that was just
will
an incredible.
Will he enhance our revenues? Is that what's
yes, right. Yes. Will he enhance our revenues? I mean, it was sort of like the games we play when we're kids and we're trading baseball cards, except this was not only real people but millions of dollars in decisions that were hinging on essentially economic logic. So to my students, I just say, well, this is the kind of fun you can have if you study hard in this particular discipline.
And we're talking, though, mostly this hour. I had to throw that in because it was interesting. It's the article in The Urbanite about Steve Walters that I did not know. And about should Baltimore City drop its property tax 1%, what would be the outcome of that? And let me give one final question, Steve Walters, before we go. So paint your vision, then, for what the 1% Baltimore would be in 4 years. If your argument is we should pass a charter amendment that says within 4 years, our property tax will be down to 1%. So you could have years of drought before you build. So talk about.
Here's the big qualm that people in the city government have about this. They just don't think this is a practical idea, and I understand where they're coming from. No city has done this kind of policy voluntarily. San Francisco and Boston, as I said before, this was forced upon them.
By statewide referendums.
Right. The state taxpayers revolted and dragged the cities along for the ride. Now, the practical problem here is if you cut the property tax rate by more than half, you immediately take a very large hit on property tax revenues. Now, what the data from San Francisco show is those revenues recover. They recover over a few years. The property tax revenues recover to their former level in real inflation-adjusted terms within 8 years. But other revenues recover much more rapidly because, again, you've got some payroll tax revenues. You've got some tax and recordation tax revenues. So in San Francisco's case, their budget fell for the first 3 years after Proposition 13. Their spending had to fall for 3 years, but then in the fourth year, it recovered and exceeded the pre-Proposition 13 level. So here's the plan for Baltimore. Don't do this today and say the property tax rate as of 5 p.m. Friday is going to go to 1%. What you do is you give investors fair warning, and you invite in the tidal wave of investment development over the next few years by saying, let's rewrite a charter amendment that says the property tax rate in Baltimore City is 1% of market value, and ever it shall be. If you want to change this, it will need a supermajority of a popular referendum that would require a supermajority or something like that, so that investors would know, okay, from now on, it's 1% in Baltimore. But then you date that effective charter amendment 4 years from now. And then you allow the development to occur. You allow people to start buying up property and rehabbing it. And you go through more than one assessment cycle. You start writing up the values of the improved property. The tax and recordation fees start rolling in. You put that in here's my Al Gore voice, lockbox. You put the revenues that are flowing in over that time in the lockbox, and then you say, okay, well, that's our rainy day fund. When the property tax rate does fall in 4 years, we can draw on the rainy day fund to cover budget shortfalls. But by the time the property tax rate actually does go down, your tax base should have broadened sufficiently so that there really isn't much of a shortfall. So that's, in effect, one of my colleagues has described this as, well, building the bridge before you actually have to cross it. I mean, San Francisco and Boston didn't have that option. This was a surprise to them. But we do. So we can do it that way. And I think most people would say, yeah, I'm willing to take a hit for a couple of years with a high property tax rate while I rehab property and buy up new housing and businesses. And then once the property tax rate goes down to 1%, then it's a new world for everybody. Baltimore gets more people, gets a broader base to their tax profile. They'll have more piggyback tax revenue. They'll have more sales tax revenue and so forth. And it'll be a better city. It'll be a bigger city. It'll have more people, and it'll be a richer city.
Well, Dr. Steve Malters, thank you for joining us for the latest edition of Urbanite Broadcasting on the Mark Steiner Show. Pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks.
And you can read the words here in the December issue of the Urbanite. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with another story from this month's Urbanite magazine. We'll meet the creator of a new website that's not only a labor of love, but a labor of obsession. It's the first online annotated version of Moby Dick, the great novel that was not only about obsession, but a product of obsession. Stay with us right after the break to meet its creator, Margaret Guroff. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late, Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome to another Urbanite broadcast here as part of the Mark Steiner Show in our collaboration with the Urbanite magazine. In the December 2008 issue, there was a story by a once Baltimorean, Meg Guroff, who used to be at Baltimore Magazine. She's now at AARP, and she wrote a piece for her first piece for the Urbanite called Why Did I Create My Online Shrine to Moby Dick? We're about to find out. And Meg, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Welcome back to Baltimore for a little bit.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I was here on Sunday.
So that, not that far away, really, is it?
It's true.
So, all right, the first question is, here we have your website, which I'm looking at, www.powermobydick.com, and you can just get that up on the web now if you're listening to us. And the issue is, and the article is in this month's Urbanite, December's issue. So talk a bit about the nature of obsession, which was Herman Melville's obsession with writing Moby Dick and your obsession with Moby Dick.
Right. Just start talking.
Tell us about that.
You know, you mentioned my obsession with the book, which is evident from the website. For anybody who's looking at it, it's quite ornate.
It's a great website.
Oh, thank you.
Really easy to access.
Thank you very much. And Melville was obsessed with writing this book. And as you know, the book itself is about obsession. It's about Captain Ahab's obsession with finding and killing the whale that had bitten off his leg. And so I hadn't really intended to even read the book, let alone make a website about it. But a friend of mine talked me into starting it. And as soon as I started, I was just swept away by the language in the book.
Why were you swept away by the language in the book?
Well, it's, Melville plays with language in a way that a lot of contemporary writers don't. He uses a lot of archaic words and references, and also a lot of words that he made up. And so it's very dense. You can read the same sentence 10 times and get something different out of it each time. So it's a beautiful book. It's also hilarious and dirty. But you can't – it's difficult for a contemporary reader to just approach it without any kind of a gloss, which is what I was attempting to do. And I found as I was reading it that I was looking up, you know, every other word online, basically.
To find out what it meant.
To find out what it meant, to find out – you know, to understand the historical figures that he was writing about or the classical references that he was writing about. And every time you look something up, there's something amazing to learn. And after a while, I decided, well, you know, I couldn't believe nobody had put all this stuff on the web together before. And I thought, well, you know, I could do that.
And you did this by yourself? You designed and put this website together?
I did. Now, when it got down to the design, I do have some friends who are in the business.
Okay.
And so I got some help with that part because this is the first thing that I'd ever put on the internet.
So Moby Dick is a great American classic, obviously, we all know, and by Herman Melville. And you call it humorous and dirty, I think.
Yes.
I'd like you to get your sense of why you think that and why you think this became such a great American classic before I talk more about your obsession.
Okay. Well, let's see. I have a good example from the first chapter of both humorous and slightly dirty. He's the main character, the narrator, is Ishmael. The first famous, very famous first line is, "Call me Ishmael." And Ishmael has decided that he's going to go on a whaling voyage, and he starts to talk about why people are drawn to the sea and what the appeal is of being on a boat. And at one point he says, let's see if I can get this right, "The headwinds are stronger than the winds from the stern, provided you observe the Pythagorean maxim." And so, you know, what's the Pythagorean maxim? Well, you know who Pythagoras was, but we're not talking about the Pythagorean theorem about triangles. We're talking about the Pythagorean maxim. When you look it up, you've learned that the Pythagoreans were this kind of crazy cult, and they had all these rules for living, and a lot of them had to do with reincarnation. And one of their rules, the maxim, was that because the shoot of a bean has some connection to reincarnation, to life, mm-hmm. you shouldn't eat beans. Because I don't know why. I mean, maybe because they had reincarnated souls in them. I don't know. But in any case, if you go back to the text, what he's saying is that the wind from the front is... Right? Stronger than the wind from the rear,
gotcha.
Provided you don't eat beans.
Right.
Yeah, and that's all the way through the book.
So now you really, it's very funny. What's a good reason not to eat beans, I suppose? Maybe that's why that happens to you, because there are all these souls in there saying, we're getting out of here.
That's so, it. Got to get out somehow.
So, so you clearly, and you took that one opening sentence, and in your website, it's full of stuff. You're clearly kind of. I mean, you. How much time did you spend doing this? Because you got so deeply into it in a way that I've never seen anybody else. I've interviewed people over the years who have been Moby Dick experts and scholars on Moby Dick, and you know, and all the rest. But this is something different. This is like kind of getting under the text and pulling out words and pulling out phrases, and it's a very different way of looking at this book, or any book, I might add.
Well, actually, I was surprised by that reaction, but a lot of people were saying they haven't seen quite this thing on the internet before.
Yeah.
I should say that being a Melville scholar, which I am not, but being a Melville scholar does require a certain amount of obsession.
You don't consider yourself a Melville scholar?
No, I don't. I don't have the training, and a lot of what I did on this site was read other people's work and kind of condense it or synthesize it and put it into this form where it was more easily accessible.
When you look at the page, I'm looking at Loomings, your very first chapter.
Yes.
That you have. And so you have, let's say, the words like Ishmael, spleen, hypos, ball, kato, Indian, Manhattos, mole, battery, just looking at what's there right now. And so they're colored in a certain color, and you look over to the right-hand side of the chapter, and you have those words listed explaining what those words mean.
Yeah.
And that's part of what you built here for us to kind of be able to get through this and understand it in a way we might not earlier.
Right.
Doing our homework for us.
Exactly. Well, I was doing my own homework. Uh-huh. I mean, basically, this site, everything that's highlighted on the site is a word that I didn't understand when I read it.
Which is right. Which and, you assume that most of us wouldn't know them either.
Right.
Exactly.
Right. And I should say that you can turn this off. If you want to read it for yourself.
Yes, it says hide notes.
You can just turn it off and just read it. The whole text is online. And then if something comes up that you don't understand, you can turn the notes on and see it then.
So how long did it take you to do this?
Well, it was about 3 months to read the book and do the first cut of the annotation.
And read the book and do the first cut of the annotation.
Yeah. And then I spent another month clearing up questions that I had at the library and also putting the whole thing online.
And how did you just scan it? That's how you got it on?
Well, this is...
You didn't type it all in, did you?
No. That would have taken at least 3 months all by itself.
Right.
No, this is one of the internet's many blessings, is that works that are out of copyright, which is, in this country, anything that was written by someone who has died more than 100 years ago, I think, mm-hmm. are in the public domain. You can do whatever you want with them. So this text existed online. There are tons... It's mind-blowing how many texts exist online. There's a guy... I think at Temple University, at some Pennsylvania university, who has something called the online books page, where he keeps track of every text that people have put online, and a lot of the texts that Melville was referring to in this book, mm-hmm. that even 10 years ago or 20 years ago, somebody doing this would have had to go to archives to look at, were available to me just through Google.
Right here.
Yeah.
I love this website. I mean, it's amazing. I'm going to come up more about Moby Dick and your sense of him, sense of this book and why it became what it became, and also explore this obsession and the monomania of the period that may be yours as well.
I don't deny it.
We'll come back to that. But you have other things on your website like Orson Welles, Whales,
yes.
by Alex Eitan, mm-hmm. right? That's on your website, and it's an animated...
This is a kind of a trippy animation by this guy in New York. And I should say, this is one... I have a weekly feature on the site called Cultural Fallout of the Week.
Yes, I saw that.
That follows... It just and the way I do this is just I have a Google alert set up, and mm-hmm. whenever anybody writes about Moby Dick in their blog, I'm notified. And so every week...
So if I wrote Moby Dick on my blog...
I would read your blog.
So it's a secret way of getting in touch with you. I just have to write Moby Dick on the blog, and
true.
All of a sudden you'll know that I'm there.
I will appear and lurk on your site. I know. It's very sad. I can't believe I'm confessing to all this on the radio. But so every week there are 8 to 10 cultural artifacts that are responses to Moby Dick. And people today are doing this all the time. And this guy, Alex Eitan, who I do not know, his art is to do animations on pages of books that he loves. And he did this, maybe it's a 5-minute comic.
Yeah, that's 4.5 minutes.
And it has something to do with Moby Dick. I mean, it the soundtrack is from the Led Zeppelin song Moby Dick and also from the 1956 movie of Moby Dick. And there are whales in it, but then it's also his own thing. I mean, there are parts of it that I don't really see the connection to the book, mm-hmm. but it's clearly, born of the book.
So now, this is fascinating. So I wonder how much traffic you've gotten or how many comments you've gotten from people who are Moby Dick scholars, people who have made their life, their academic existence built around Herman Melville and Moby Dick.
I have heard from some. A lot of my contact with these people is on a Google listserv called Ishmaelites, where many of them...
Ishmaelites.
And they talk about Melville's work on an extremely high level that I frequently do not understand.
Uh-huh. We're not talking about some biblical split here with the Ishmaelites.
Exactly.
You're talking about something...
No. You could probably do a whole website based on the genesis of that. But when I have a question, something that I didn't understand, I can post it there and then they'll help me out. One person who I am in frequent contact now with is a guy in Israel who is translating the book into Hebrew.
Wow.
And he's doing not just a translation, but an annotated translation.
So like yours.
But
translating into Hebrew.
Exactly. Right. But so what he's doing is not only, this is Melville's words and the sense of the words, but then he's pulling out, Melville, when he writes about this such and such a poem, here's the poem that he's talking about. And I hear from this guy all the time. I love hearing from him.
So are you doing that as well?
Am I?
Referring to the poems and...
Yes, in my site, where I could find the poem, I would mention the poem and also, in a lot of cases, link to the poem so that you can read for yourself.
You make a... I'm going to come back to some of the things that you've done here. In a second, but I just want to come back to an article you wrote for The Urbanite that got all this started, at least got us started with your site. And let me remind you, while you're listening to a conversation with Meg Guroff here on The Mark Steiner Show, this is one of our Urbanite broadcasts because she wrote a piece in December's Urbanite called Why Did I Create My Online Shrine to Moby Dick? And you can go to www.powermobydick.com to see what we're talking about and to check out her website. But you write, it was a very cute little piece you wrote in The Urbanite about, and I mean cute in lack of substance, I mean cute because the way it was written was humorous, around the notion of obsession, whether it was your obsession with Moby Dick and the Captain Ahab, the main character, one of the main characters of Moby Dick, and his obsession, or Melville's obsession, So, obsession. Mm-hmm. Talk a bit about this obsession and the connection you have here.
Well, one thing, you know, I got obsessed with the book, as I think.
When did you first read the book?
This was the first time I read it. I thought that I'd read it before, actually, because I was supposed to read it in high school.
We were all supposed to read it in high school.
Yeah, and you know, you kind of, I may have written a paper about it.
And lied.
Lying is such an ugly word.
Okay, like, all right. Well, it's a subterfuge of some kind
exactly,
to get the grade, right?
Exactly. Right. But, you know, when I started reading it again with a friend of mine wanted to read it, and I thought, well, I'll keep you company, you know. That's when I realized that I had never read it, because after the first couple of pages, it was all fresh to me. It was all new. But to answer your question about obsession, I mean, one of the things that happened during the course of the book is that I really got more and more into, you know, what was going to happen and also understanding what was going to happen. I think a lot of people have this experience of a book they get into. The longer I read it, the more of my day was devoted to reading it. So that by the end, the last few chapters, I just stayed up all night and read. And then, you know, eventually launched the website and told my buddy Dave, who's the editor of The Urbanite, about it. And he said, you know, I really think that you should write an essay for us about why you got so obsessed with that. And so as part of the research for the essay, I came across this book that was new in November called Obsession, A History, by a guy named Leonard Davis.
You refer to it in your article.
Yeah. And this book I found fascinating because he talks a lot about how obsession came to be considered a mental disorder. For most of the history of mankind, it was something that was considered a spiritual disorder. You were obsessed or possessed by demons. It wasn't something that had to do with your brain or with your thought processes, which is obviously the way we think about it now. And it was not that long before Melville wrote his book that the people's understanding of what obsession was began to change. And Davis makes the argument that it had to do with a change in culture, with the Industrial Revolution and the switch from people needing to do many things, whether you were, you know, running a farm and having to also be the blacksmith and everything, or, you know, you were of the aristocracy and you were a doctor and also a philosopher and this and that, people began to focus more specifically on one line of thought, on one way of making a living. And as part of that, doctors began to diagnose a disorder called monomania, which they said was this persistent focus, this on one thing, that, you know, an obsessive, inevitable kind of focus on one thing. And that's what Melville says that Captain Ahab has, that when he went after this whale, it was all he could think about. And he lost all his judgment for any other facet of his life.
Did you do that as well during this, you think?
I think to a certain extent I did. Now, another interesting thing about his book, which is something that...
Whose book now?
The book about obsession, right. The history of obsession. A point that he makes that I hadn't really thought of, but that I think is very true, is that this is obsession is something that you kind of need in order to succeed in modern life, especially in America. And that the people that you see who are extraordinarily successful and admirable, you know, for example, Barack Obama, is somebody who is single-mindedly focused on one thing and devotes an extraordinary amount of energy to that one thing. And the only thing that makes that admirable is the goal, the end. So it's a way in which the end does sort of justify the means. And one of the examples, I don't think I ended up using it in the essay, but one thing I thought about was while I was writing the essay, there was this 41-year-old Olympic swimmer who had this amazingly harsh regimen for herself to get herself into shape. And all these stories, you know, writing about how incredible it was that she could do this and how could she do this and shouldn't we all be doing this? And I thought, you know, if this person weren't a contender, if this were somebody who were doing the exact same things, exactly the same, but were a horrible, horrible swimmer, you know, she would be, you know, she would be considered insane. And this obsession, you know, she would be considered obsessed in a way instead of being motivated. So I feel like a lot of what we see as obsession, we call that just because we don't really understand why the person is doing it. We don't endorse the end result.
And the website you have, I love all the pieces on here. There's the essay you have in here that you have on right now by Stephen Kinzer that was in The Guardian called Call Me Bush. Moby Dick is an eerily prophetic allegory of 21st century America. It should be named as the nation's epic novel.
Yes.
I love that. So, I mean, you have – that's the things that are great about this site is you have all these pieces. Orson Welles, it was just the animation – artist Paul Jackson's collage, The Chase, inspired by the book, a video game style T-shirt, Ahab Battles, Moby Dick, Meryl Streep limps in, I haven't read this one yet, Meryl Streep limps in the film Doubt because of Captain Ahab. All these, I mean, it's just, and you found all these things.
They found me.
They found you. Because of Google?
Because of Google Alerts. Yes, that's my secret.
Your secret is Google Alerts.
Yes. Once in a while, somebody will alert me to something. I've found some really interesting things that way. Another one from this week while we're talking is a lady and an artist in Connecticut whose project is to visit businesses that are named Moby Dick.
Oh, I see. Yes, right.
Yeah. And so for 3 years, I don't think full time, but, you know, she's devoted a lot of time here in this country and also in Europe to finding like Moby Dick Marina, Moby Dick, you know, in Washington we have Moby Dick House of Kebabs, you know, and she would,
Moby Dick's House of Kebabs?
We do. Y'all should come down. Yeah. They are very fine kebabs, I have to say. But, you know, so she's photographed these businesses and now she has a show of her photography of all these Moby Dick related or inspired businesses from the Western world.
How that mostly kind of Muslim fare, kebab got mixed up with Moby Dick.
Well, you know, on the Pequod, on the ship, there's every kind of a person. It's like a mini United Nations.
That's one of the things I loved about Moby Dick when I first read it a long time ago. And then I read it the second time 10 years ago, was that Melville was this abolitionist. He couldn't stand slavery and the whole race issue in America. And he was a progressive thinker. Mm-hmm. And his book is just full of all aspects of human society and not just the white world, which for that time was a pretty radical notion to put in a book.
Right, right. And it's also very homoerotic.
The book is homoerotic.
Yes. So it's got that going for it, too. There's a lot of transgression in this book. I mean, one of...
So they might ban the book, like in California, they've done Proposition 8.
Perhaps
no
Moby
Dick.
You know, they really... The first British edition, which actually was produced before the first American edition, it was released before, it was heavily Bowdlerized. They cut out a lot of stuff that had to do with monarchy, a lot of stuff about religion, a lot of the stuff about Ishmael's relationship with this harpooner Queequeg, which was extremely affectionate, you could say.
Queequeg was a Native American.
Queequeg was from us.
No, that's right. I'm wrong. Yes.
He was tattooed all over his body, and he was from the South Pacific.
South Pacific. I had the wrong character. Yeah, I'm sorry.
And he's the harpooner. The first thing that happens when Queequeg gets to, when Ishmael gets to New Bedford is that he has to find a place to sleep. And the innkeeper says, oh, you can sleep here, but there's somebody already sleeping in that bed. So he's like, you know, after some trepidation, he ends up going in, waiting for this bedmate to come. And it's just these two guys who are both assigned to the same bed at a hotel. And they end up, you know, pretty cozy.
So you have this international, multiracial, homoerotic book from the 1840s. And it didn't make it in the 1840s.
That is true. 1851, I
1851,
should say.
Right. 1850, excuse me. I'm sorry. Right.
It's – yeah, please.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Okay.
I'm sorry. I know. See, this is when it comes out. You know, I should be able to let that kind of thing go.
Yeah, you shouldn't.
It was a flop, and it destroyed his career. Melville – he did publish another book or two after this, and then in the end he wrote poetry. But he had been a very successful writer of travel narratives because he did a lot of he traveled on a whaling ship himself,
right.
And he wrote also a book before this called White Jacket about that changed, you know, it brought up the problem of flogging in the Navy.
Yes.
And He was a very important writer, but this book did horribly. And, you know, he died in poverty and in obscurity.
So tell me now what we're going to do with your website and where you take the obsession with Moby Dick in this wonderful website, powermobydick.com. Where does it go?
Well, it seems to be taking its own road. I don't really know, because when I did it, I thought, you know, I had all these notes. I thought, I'm just going to put this up on the internet, and then if anybody ever wants it, they can find it. I will put it up, and I will go on with my life. But it keeps growing. You know, I keep hearing from people. I keep thinking of other things I want to add. So we'll just see. Right now, it's the annotation and the cultural fallout and a lot of resources for people who, you know, want to go into more depth on Melville.
Well, this is great. I'm really happy that we found this in the issue. I'm glad we chose this as one of our stories. It's been great to have been talking once again with Meg Giroff, who used to be at Baltimore Magazine, now at ARP, her first story in the Urbanite magazine as part of our Urbanite broadcast. The story you can find on the web as well is called Why Did I Create My Online Shrine to Moby Dick? And the website is www.powermobydick.com. It's a phenomenal website. And Meg Giroff, it's a pleasure to see you. It's great to see you again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
That's it for us today. Thanks to Meg Giroff and Stephen Walters for joining us. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered this hour by Zachary Coleman. Our interns are Judith Lloyd and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And to hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews on the web, you can visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.